The man who killed Cheap Gas in America was the first and last of his master race. He had a photogenic horse. His name on billboards in Arkansas spelt war. Was there more to him than met the eye? The cameras made him cry when the party at large called him a winner. Now that was a bummer. He hip-shopped the politics of surface to surface and air to surface and surface to air, kept under glass his pet snail, quail. They took against him in Tripoli, as did the hoi polloi, who thought his actions not quite neutral. Are carpet bombs crucial? There were many causes under the sun. There was the UN, there was global watch it, acid catch it. What else? There was his fame for croquet, relayed daily between the news and weather. And whether he really Tunglash Schwarzkopf in 91 is speculation, and now the headlines. Nobody got him right. As on the night, he killed Cheap Gas in America with a flare that jumped even his shoulder slapping, made him a king, good old boy, backers. These were taxes for a war. Before diplomacy snapped, never dreamt plausible before. But that he showed strength, and each card in his hand, a joker, was enough. Goddamn, would they snuff him today or today? 2 years, three, and his image flipped like a shark in a slick. 100% pure, crude, one dead Jude. They took him out, showed him the ranch, root and branch, retirement, brain death. Cue the game shows, the Minnie Mouse videos. Not that this set a precedent. The President of the United States is not nice. He is ice, he is soda. He is a headline coder. And now the head rolls. Cute he was. One of us. I run a lot of workshops, and I always say to people who are new to workshops, look, kid. Well, I don't say kid, you know, so look. No adjectives, no archaisms, and no inversions. You know, watch out on the adverbs. And then I go back, and I write something like this, which breaks all those rules. Not only are there archaisms, like hath and thou, there are inversions. Now, the reason that there are all these things, you see, it's called the meat sickness. And I'm trying to get forward about 120 years. It's written in the voice of a man who is a criminal. He's very old. People live older in 120 years. They might live to the age of 120. But the meat sickness, what's this? It's something to do with BSE, perhaps? What's happened, you see, is that the country has gone to a state of total degradation from the state of minor degradation it's in now. And BSE has played a large part in this. And therefore, you might actually put in the adjectives, the archaisms, and the inversions if you were suffering from spongy brains. So it's written in his voice. The meat sickness hath history, yes, and future. But hath I my own problems, and meat be the least. First, a difficulty there was over thine application forms. Polices ran wild with mine aliases. Was I 103 when that happened, thine order coming down, should I register with the authority, an amnesty at last from the crimes of mine own lifetime? So many criteria cancelling, ho, guilt, ho, innocence. Hath they a field day taking down my colourful particulars? A risk? Know I this, but hath I capital, and money talks with a set full of teeth. Shut it snap now, mine fascinating biography. How I walked with the best murderers. How came I of age in Wandsworth at the turn of the millennium? Was Wandsworth no go, yet there were bottles and fireworks smuggled in from outside? Was there thy first public execution under thy laws in the new year? Thought I thine ways were aghast. Was there thy Restitution of Offenders Act, which left us with more than enough free time to kill what we'd left on thine streets, thy Britain? Was there our leader, who took wine with thy leaders, and slap-pocketed their money for protection? Hath shook we many, ho, promises, on the mouths of politicos, for that way lieth freedom. Don't ask guy questions and you know give answers. Am I living 122 before know I everything? The ropes, the knack, the singing grassmen? Yes, every name, as branded it is on their bellies. Am I an answer? Am I an old man with a lifetime of pocketing through thy grand imbecilities? Thy questioning of nothing that hath I witnessed here in the heart of blue England in the year 2144? Take thy meat sickness for one. Love I my hot dinners as well as any orifice, yet would you wilfit, go quite apeshit, hunger for more dollops of what finally eating your civiline race? Would thou explain the wherefore of quarantine, how in death time thy beef-eater madness made us an island forevermore, with red gulls ringed, red bloody shores? Was I, oh, such a happy boy, with mine crime and blue murder, thy enterprise laws lifting mine life to a century's grace? All the years, thee eating and thou eating your brains to a pulp that hath neither future, nor future, nor future. That's cheerful. Round up all the usual suspects. Hell. Poetry wasn't like this at school. Yes, I'm a bit of a poet myself. It just comes to me when I'm depressed. I just have to write it down or it's lost. Now look, if I've told you once, this is a poetry reading. The city you've passed through likes a bit of culture, as is evident from the 1,000 hanging baskets and the WEA and the bookshop with the Ian McEwan poster. The last poet of the evening is reading the last poem before closing time. He's already said, to finish with, I'll read. And then he's read. And then you've said, hell, poetry wasn't like this at school. Yes, I'm a bit of a poet myself. It just comes to me when I'm depressed. I just have to write it down or it's lost. Look, if I've told you once, this is poetry. Everybody's kept to time except a local poet who has a thing about Moreland, a thing about Bronte, a thing about Faye Godwin, and then he's read about when he's dead. Look, the audience is mostly local poets who have read Remains of Elmet 3 times and something of Bronte to offset the Dante they never actually got round to. Because they've said, hell, poetry wasn't like this at school. Yes, I'm a bit of a poet myself. It just comes to me when I'm depressed. I just have to write it down or it's lost. And if I've told you once, the local poet says, I stood by the cruel black rocks, motherly rain, earth sucked by blasted roots, the moon's ghost sliver and the eternal blood clock. Look, says a hanging basket to the Ian McEwan poster. This is a poetry reading. Adrian Boswell could do better than this and still remain true to his mum because he's read, well, nothing. Because he said, hell, at least you can turn me off. Yes, I'm a bit of a basket myself. I've bought a squareal and now I'm depressed because, well, give us a break. Nobody's supposed to enjoy this, are they? I've just come down from this place in Scotland called Hawthornden Castle, where it's supposed to be a retreat for writers. The book I'm working on at Hawthornden is, the publisher calls it translations of the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam. That's a bad word for what I'm doing. I'm not translating, I'm no translator. I'm adapting themes and variations from Mandelstam's poems and from his life. I mean, Mandelstam didn't write this next poem. It's like a workshop that I've run where we were supposedly translating other people's poems into English. And what I did was I gave each of them a prose translation of 4 poems by people like Alberti and Rilke and big stars like this. And I also gave somebody a prose poem by a Manchester poet called John Ash and told them it was in fact in a foreign language. And of course, they translated this English prose poem into a new poem. It's a process called transliteration. And basically, my theory behind all this is that most poets are just doing exactly the same thing. Because if you're traditional, if you're fairly traditional in your aspect, as most good poets are, they're looking at the past, all they are doing is transliterating. I mean, the subjects that really turned Alexander Pope on are the subjects which turn us on. I mean, Pope knew a few things. You know, he'd been in bed and known the pain and known the emotion, though sometimes it doesn't quite come through. Mandelstam, you need a bit of background for those who don't know about Mandelstam. Was this Russian poet who was, he just couldn't take Stalin very seriously. One thing that people seem to miss out about Mandelstam is that he was a real joker. He was making jokes all the time. And he wrote this poem about Stalin, which compared him to all sorts of very nasty things. And in fact, it's quite funny. And it wasn't ever written down. He whispered it into the ears of 15 friends, and one of them shopped him. He was exiled to this town called Voronezh, which wasn't so bad, only he was starving, and he was poor, and they couldn't get work, and he was half mad. And in 1938, he was rearrested and sent to a transit camp. And he was last seen scavenging off a rubbish tip. And the official report said he had a heart attack. But one can believe what one likes. Either way, Mandelstam has survived. I was very pleased to see that the Voice Box did a special event, because this is his centenary year. He was born in 1891. The interrogation. He looked up and realized he was blind. Where was the lake? More to the point, who was this character yanking at his hand? The voice behind it had a familiar accent, and the words, well, the words were quality. They were simple, limpid, sweet as oil. He couldn't get enough. It was like reading Dante, with the words folding about him like coral. But the blindness, how could he explain that? If it were to finish by waking up, how his public would laugh at him. Perhaps he should shout. Perhaps he should address his questions to the lake. But that would be interrupting. Whoever the bastard was, he could certainly talk. And it was worth listening to. It was like hearing the world, or like the way seabirds are tuned into the surf's white noise, despite the distance and landmass. Maybe he was being offered a sound map, a system, if you like, for all the necessary answers his interrogators would eventually get out of him. The chateau windows are as big as doors. Outside, five cars have tremored to a halt, their engines smoking with cold. They are black and wide and official. The snow clutches the perfect lines of their wheels. Soon there will be footprints ghosting the courtyard, lamplight, shouts. Something, say a fox, might look from a distance. Someone, say a farmer, might pass its bright, open aspect. No. There is no more to it than snow stroking the roof. No more to it than marksmen posted on the main gates. But somebody departs on cue, running softly through the half-invisible gardens. Hard going, with snow covering him like fur. When he reached the lake, touched down on water, he felt where his shoulder, well, where it ached, where the razor had been, where a quick red cut was opening and closing like a mouth. These are priorities. Keep them in mind. Priority one, attempt to control the shivering. Priority two, hide from the wind. I have another theory as well about Mandelstam, and that is that in order to avoid the sins of his poetry being visited upon his wife and his friends, A lot of the poems were stuffed in shoes or in pots and pans. And Nadia Mandelstam herself memorized a great deal of the poems. Now, after Stalin died and these poems came to the surface, there were a number of translations done. Now, one of the reasons I started this was purely academic, and that was I was dissatisfied with a number of the translations. There were switches in the meaning which I couldn't quite grasp, almost non sequiturs of images. And my theory was, and I've been fairly pleased to find a number of people who know about this subject agreeing, is that what happened was Nadia Mandelstam, although she remembered the poems extraordinarily well under the conditions, it's bound to happen that some will be misremembered, lines will be missed out, and thus you'll get non sequiturs when it's transcribed. So in all these poems, there are points, perhaps, which you might feel, what the hell is he going on about? And it's actually there in Mandelstam. It's part of the charm. It's like almost a surreal exercise. This last poem. Now, when you say this last poem, everybody goes, whew, it's very long. And they go, ugh. But I'll read it very fast. So it's a case of bear with me. Come along for the ride. Shooting the breeze. My neighbours, firstborn of informers, you practice duplicity in shrugs and murmurs. How somebody brought you lilacs is a new story. I let you in the flat with your fist of colours. Flowers are for living, That you ask questions. Have you been writing? And can I read it? The point is, you are bored and unhappy, and the point has been reached. You need a vase today and want ours. You will sell us if we speak, and if we don't, you will grab our belongings. You clench flowers, good neighbours, and ask for the loan of a vase today, at any cost, to hold those sick purples in bouquet. We will give you instead tea and stories. I will give you a desire to have. Why this vase and no other? What holds your lives together, you two cut lilacs, my good neighbours? Sit down and let me murmur purple mythologies. Yes, you have scanned me with your eyes before. And what did you see? A possibility? Yes. But you grip bright flowers, good neighbours, and they fret for water. You need a vase to hold you in good humour. A story might be pleasant, and delay you for a second. No, it's just a story. And here's the tea. And here are flowers. Now, the parents of the Nereids faced your dilemma through the seized door of their public love. All her daughters born so fashionably underwater. How their tresses snagged on fins and coral. How the tight, mythological ocean couldn't contain that splendid hair. What an ejaculation of hair and daughters and hair problems. Oh, neighbours, you're shocked and half thinking of the police. Wait, this is legend. This is not how it is. The hair. It spread like a shoal of gold. Light surprised it at the surface, so that fishermen fussed about the price of nets, the role of barbers. Why their sea and no other? But looking from their ships, men saw the hair, felt desire crawl in their crotches like a lobster, watched animals snatched up in it, copulating and spilling on each other. Men wanted to leap, lash out through the prisms of hair, its gold spun so violently they might kill their wives. And the changes, look, how pipefish grew longer, mothered from keratin, heads engorged like sunflowers. Those shreds of gold leaf which were plankton, eyes of flatfish, candid as coins, shark teeth, gold dentistry. Currents of disbelief weaving yellow envy through the coral's new cutlery. How rich, eh? How in retrospect land seen more a museum, where men's deaths were for the asking underclass. And each private love, so very, very costly, they paid for every word. Men flung themselves at the wonder, heads cracked, ha, grew happy. Millions of them, happy, died. Let's shoot the breeze while the sea loves them to distraction. Let's talk around the dead, the lives that chose. Let's cut the crap about believing everything under the sun. Take it from me. Back home where market reports in triplicates, the price of silver rocketing on the world exchange, so much gold and blood in the sea rack, all for the having, for the weeping of wives. A gold merchant in the capital formed a notion, a cartel, to empty the seas one by one, to dry in the sun this hair, then burn it, burn the lilac bodies, to drain the daughters, the death murderers, at source. As for the parents of these killers, they were dead from love, had washed the matter right out of their hair, had suddened into reality, or legend, or whatever you find, good neighbours, cheap and lovely. Only the light helped him, an unlikely partner. No sooner had a sea of bodies vanished than another splashed to land, violet with history. Books were written, and the merchant ghosted them, statistics silvered down from his pen. The trade in lives bulged in his pockets. He strode the bounds of his country, muttering his luck, holding fingers to lips so breath might not escape. Why, his people were free from complaint, free from themselves, either dead or dying in water, on land. What was the past to him? He should not wonder. He mouthed this hard mythology like a song, was as hungry as the weather, eating whole oceans, hair, and life. His name? You know his name. It is tight with blood. His time? You know his time? Don't know his time? Yet it is all about time. See, the parents of the Nereids had your difficulties. Firstborn like yourselves had spawned such killing. Still, it was beautiful murder at the price. Land and seas emptied, the merchant crowned and rich again. How during spring tides he drowned his children. See, firstborn whisperers, I have given you history, and you are hungry for names, and mine will bulge your mouths. Go with our belongings, and our vase, and our tea, and shoot the breeze with bullets, now you have evidence. Go. It is about time. No water in a vase will hold our lilac dead in Bokeh. Their ghosts move along the seabeds in Armenia or Azerbaijan, searching for their loved ones. Their graves are steep in mythology and hair. My neighbours, you have evidence. You practice duplicity in shrugs and murmurs. Have somebody brought you flowers? Have somebody brought you? Thanks.